Welcome to Solutions OP Clinical Trials Podcast. My name is Olga and I'm the Managing Director of Solutions OP. We are a small team of experienced professionals working on clinical trials in the United Kingdom. I'll use our podcast to discuss hot topics in clinical trials and provide analysis of the latest trends and challenges in pharma and medical device industries, not just in the UK, but globally. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the next episode of the podcast. Today I will preview some of the changes in the latest ICH-GCP changes. So for those of you who are in the industry and keep up to date what's going on, you know that the International Council of for Harmonization released their latest edition of the GCP recommendations in January 2025. So there are a lot of people who wrote about that, so I decided to record a podcast and just discuss some topics which I think are very, very important for people to pay attention. So the reason for the changes in the GCP is to reflect the fact that there are a lot of new technologies and new challenges in clinical research, and the old GCP guideline was no longer fit for purpose. So in this episode, I plan to cover some of the main changes which I think are relevant for pharma and biotech industry. So the very first thing I would like to mention here is that the GCP recommends for the first time, recommendations for the first time mention the usage of wearables and sensors as data sources. Furthermore, the new guideline encourage the use of new technologies which are fit for purpose in a specific clinical trial. And this is something very new for those who remember the old GCP. And I think it's very important to have that clarification because there's been a lot of uncertainties back in the time when there are new technologies. Can we actually use them in clinical trials? Is it appropriate and so on? So I think this is really good to have that clarification. There is another thing, however, I would like to discuss here. So we have to pay attention to fit for purpose for the specific clinical trial. I think this is very important because there are a lot of new diagnostic tests that companies are used to using clinical trials to evaluate their endpoints, and not all of them are actually commercially available on the market. So that puts a lot new challenges for these companies, because if you have used a test which is not validated and available commercially on the market to evaluate your endpoints, you might have a lot of problems later on when you present your data to the regulators. So this is something that you need to think about, and this is why I think GCP is telling you that these new technologies and whatever you're using need to be fit for purpose. So this is an important point that people have to consider when designing their clinical trials. The GCP guidelines recommend the use of communities and patient advocacy groups as part of the research, and to consider the complexity of the clinical trials and how this will affect the participants. So this will make a big difference for the development of rare disease treatments and medical devices, because it will provide more flexibilities to companies when they can discuss something with the patients and try to design it around the patients in a way that it will work for them as well. So that's a positive thing, and it was something that was missing in the previous guideline. So another point is the new guidelines are talking for the first time of risk mitigation and risk proportionality. So this is really new approach. For those of you who remember, the old version of GCP had a lot more rigid language when it comes to risk, and it was more in favor of avoidance than proportionality. So this new approach basically allow companies to really assess what is important, what data is important for them to collect, what kind of assessments they need to have, which could support them for their marketing authorization, and then design their study around this one, rather than creating some template that you have to follow and everyone doing the same thing. I think this was what was happening in the past. We had more or less all the companies trying to design the studies in a similar way so that they can produce, you know, similar results. Well, now you have that opportunity to use different methods, really, and assess the risk in your clinical trial and design around this risk. And I think this is really great new feature and opportunity for the companies. And I hope companies in the pharma and biotech industry will take advantage of this opportunity and will not try to stick to the old way of doing things. There is also special language recommending not to exclude unnecessary participants who may benefit from the treatment. And this is in contrast with the current practices and old recommendations, which were in favor of excluding vulnerable groups. So, for example, many people with special needs would be excluded if they were not able to give consent for themselves. However, the GCP guide recognizes that in some cases, you don't need such heterogeneous population and you might need to exclude some patients. So, for example, if you're doing early phase research or bioequivalence studies, then you might need a very specific patient population to do that initial research. This is a very positive thing. I think it's really great to allow as many patients to participate in research and not exclude people just for the sake of excluding them. I remember back in the days, and probably many of you remember if you work in cancer research, it was a very standard thing to exclude patients who had brain mets. So even if they were stable and they might be able to participate, it was like the trials were in favor of excluding these patients rather than considering them. And we saw during the years that this changed, gradually changed, and now we have a lot more oncology clinical trials where we include patients who might have brain mets. So that was a very positive thing. And here, they're really giving us this opportunity to sit down and think what patients we need and consider everyone who will be potentially suitable for the study. The new guideline also used the term legally acceptable representative and clarifies that this is a person who acts in the participant's best interests. So this could be, in some cases, a relative or someone from the family, friend, or it could be a physician in other cases. So unlike the USA, where the use of legal representative is common, in Europe and other parts of the world, it's a lot more cautious when it comes to legal representative. And the reason is purely legal, because when you say legal representative, you would expect to have some kind of legal authorization for that person to represent the patient. Actually, this is not very common. Not every patient or not every person will have someone who is legally authorized to represent them. So I think this is a positive change to talk about legally acceptable representative instead of legal representative. And it will help avoid a lot of confusions. So the another recommendation is the informed consent to be clear and concise with no one in the industry so far has successfully achieved this. So we never know. Hopefully this will happen and one day we'll have a really good written informed consent, which people will enjoy reading. We all hope for that. So one of the new additions is also the mentioning of using electronic technologies to obtain consent. This is something that's been widely discussed in the industry, and yet many feel very uncomfortable with using electronic informed consents. I think this is, again, a very positive thing, because you have different types of studies. Sometimes you have observational studies where participants are not necessarily coming regularly to clinic to be able to be consented. So bringing someone just to sign a paperwork, you know, might not be very feasible. That might put off patients from participating. Or sometimes you even have studies where they collect retrospective data. And for such patients, do you really need to bring them to clinic just to consent so you can collect data which is already available? There are a lot of cases where I think the electronic consent would be very good option for patients. And I really hope more companies will consider it in the future and try to use it. So another interesting addition in the clinical trial, in the GCP recommendations, is that the clinical trial should be designed and conducted by qualified individuals. And he mentions ethicists, technology experts, scientists, monitors, regulators, and biostatisticians, in addition to the physicians, nurses, and study coordinators. So this is a very good and important clarification. Why? Because we had in the past many cases where monitors were hired without any experience, they were given any minimal training, and they were sent out to do monitoring because everyone thinks this is the easiest work in the world that you can possibly do. And we saw a lot of tragedies because of this. And there are a lot of problems when you don't have a proper monitoring and oversight of your clinical trial. So the requirement to have a qualified individual, I think it's important. And I really hope more companies will spend more time training new people and make sure that people understand the disease area and many other things before they're sent out to do monitoring on their own. So another interesting part is, in case of patient withdrawal from the study, the investigator should try to establish the reason and minimize dropouts, because this could affect the study data quality. So however, then the participant decision should be respected. If they don't want to be contacted, then you don't contact them. But I think it's very important here that we have a stress on the fact that it's good to collect data once someone has consented for clinical trial and try to collect that data. It's particularly important in oncology clinical trials where very often the endpoints are overall survival of the patient. So if we don't have information if the patient is alive, in let's say 1 or 2 or 3 years after they've completed the clinical trial, this could really affect the quality of the data and the whole analysis of the data. And I think in such cases, it's really important that we have some provision to allow us to collect this data. We just want to know basically if the patient is alive. That's all we need to know. But that information could really help with the analysis of the data. So I think this is an important clarification that missing data, especially with the example that I gave, this could really affect the study quality and the analysis and even the overall outcome of the drug. I mean, if you have a lot of missing data like that, it might turn out that your drug failed, even though, you know, it might actually work, but because you don't have the data, you can't really tell if you meet the overall survival endpoint. So it is very, very important to have the data that you need for your study. So when it comes to drug administration, the new guidelines allow the drugs to be shipped to participants and supplied locally. So this is something that was missing in the past. It became optional, option only during COVID. And I think it's a great clarification, because I remember during COVID, there was a lot of discussions, can we send these drugs actually to the patients? What happens here and so on? Now I think people feel a lot more comfortable to send the drugs directly to the patients. And I personally don't see reason why not. If we can have the information and make sure that the patient can continue with their treatment, there's no reason why we can't just ship the drug to the patient directly. So that will, I think, will help logistically a lot. In the section of medical records, there is a text which says that unnecessary transcription steps should be avoided. This will particularly affect those hospitals who have electronic medical records but still keep research records on paper. there is always risk if you have paper records and electronic records. There's always risk that you have discrepancies. So the more sources you have, the more likely is that you have discrepancies. So basically the new GCP recommendations are try to stick to one type of records and just stay with this one and don't create a bigger mess with your data by adding more sources. Another interesting point is the case of security breach, which is significant. The new guidelines recommend not only notifying the sponsor if there's security breach, but also the ethics committee. Another point is that the sponsor section now includes requirement to engage patients in study documents design, which was not a priority in the past, but we see many, many regulators around the world in Europe and in the European Union, and in the UK, we have that as well, but also in the USA, and I believe in Canada is very much similar. We have that requirement from regulators that we involve patients a lot more. I've read also Japan is having something similar as an initiative. So it's rolling more globally that we want to have patients involved in research. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a positive thing. The new guideline gives a lot more flexibility on monitoring, with stressing on risk assessment and considering remote and decentralized monitoring. In the past, it was more or less, well, it was basically on-site monitoring as an option. The guide also mandates the development of monitoring plan. It also gives opportunity for monitoring only critical data in order to reduce the burden for the investigators and increase the overall budget. I think it is very critical to have monitoring which is adequate for the clinical trial, what you're trying to achieve. The old model where we had a lot monitoring and it was very frequent monitoring, it worked back in the days, but I think now having different studies with different risk assessment, it will also require risk assessment when it comes to monitoring, and people need to adapt and consider the needs of the trial and not just go and do whatever they normally do in all other studies. So I think this is very, very positive. The decentralized monitoring as well is a very important part. I believe you cannot simply rely on someone going on site and reviewing data. The data review needs to be consistent, and when you do it all the time and throughout the study, at the end you have a lot cleaner data and you're in a better position to close the study. But it requires work throughout the study, not just at the very end or when you have a monitoring visit, because at the end of the day the CRA is just one person, so you can't expect that person to be able to pick up everything, so you need to have another pair of eyes. So the new guideline clearly states that it is sponsor responsibility to report any new safety information to the regulators and also to the investigators. This will be particularly challenging in the cases where pharma companies are providing grants to universities and charities to conduct research with their drugs. Now, that's the biggest pharmacovigilance issue which no one's talking about. So basically the new GCP guideline is saying, well, it's the sponsor of the clinical trial responsibility to provide information about the drug and any new information, any new safety information. However, if that's not your study, if that's not your drug, the study is yours but the drug is not yours, you're using, for example, commercial product or a product from a company that donated it to you. So how do you manage that? I mean, how do you report safety information if this is not your drug and the pharmacovigilance is basically with external company? Of course, you have that relationship with them and you rely that they will tell you if there's anything new. But at the end of the day, you don't actually have direct oversight on this. So how do you How do you guarantee you report everything to the regulators? I have to be honest, I feel very uncomfortable with this thing, because you are the sponsor, you use drug which is not yours. What if you don't have some information or safety information, or you don't receive it on time? So what happens then? It's like, it's your responsibility, because you must respond to provide that information to the regulators. But if it hasn't been sent to you, well, what do you do then? It could be a really significant safety concern. So I hope the regulators will come up with some clarification and solution to this problem. So the drug management section suggests that the sponsor is responsible to ensure continuous treatment to the participants of the participants. This could be done by extended access scheme or switching participants to appropriate standard of care options. So the new guideline also recognizes that the risk-based approach is needed in the data review process, which is in contrast with in the past, where we had like 100% source data verification. Now you can do a targeted source data verification, which is on the critical points for you and for your study. And if that is combined carefully with decentralized monitoring, I think you can have a really a good approach, and you can have a better budget for your clinical trial as well. So there is a clarification that in cases where the hospitals use electronic medical records, they need to be assessed if they are fit for purpose in the context of the trial. So this removes a lot of previous uncertainties on who is responsible for the medical records review and validation. I remember in the past we've always had these questions and discussions with colleagues, like, okay, so who what I'm supposed to check now in the electronic medical records? How do I know they're validated and so on? And now this is really leaves the responsibility of the electronic medical records to the hospital. So all that validation and checking is their responsibility, and the sponsor responsibility is to confirm that the data collected is actually adequate for the purpose of the clinical trial, which definitely makes a big difference. So I don't need to understand how they're validating the electronic medical records. And to be honest with you, I don't think it's in the scope of our work, and we don't necessarily have understanding how this should be done. So it's really hard for a monitor, for example, to evaluate how the electronic medical records are validated, simply because we just don't have the knowledge to do that kind of assessment. So for the first time, the GCP guideline mandates clinical trials results to be made publicly available. In addition, researchers should be provided information on participants' treatment in blinded studies. So this is a very good one. There are a lot of regulators indeed that are trying to make companies publish their results, and this is a very good push. We want to see what's happening with the different clinical trials, and it is important for the companies to understand that they need to provide that information update to the patients at the end of the clinical trial in a suitable for them way. And I've had some cases where the sponsor will say, well, we are going to publish this in a scientific journal, so yeah, we can send that information to the patients. Well, not every patient will be able to read your paper in a scientific journal and understand it, so we need to make sure we really provide the information in an appropriate way, so that people can actually understand what is this about. Another thing is the guideline specifies that in case of computerized systems are used, the relevant metadata should be stored. Audit trials should also be kept, and this is consistent with many inspection findings from different regulators in the last couple of years. basically all the GCP training audits and trainings which involve GCP auditors, they always touch on this thing that sometimes the metadata is missing, sometimes there are no audit trails and so on. So all that information needs to be kept if we're using computerized systems. And basically the biggest non-compliance that we normally hear about is when you're using a lot of different vendors. So when you have different vendors, obviously you have different systems, and some of them might look very nice and shiny, but actually when you have to export the final data at the end of the study, it might not be really that great and might not be fit for purpose for your clinical trial. So that's something that you need to consider. And as I always recommend, particularly to smaller companies, try to avoid involving so many vendors, because this will adversely affect your clinical trial. So try to keep it simple. It's always my advice to people, try to keep it simple. So this was my very brief overview of the latest GCP updates. There are definitely some new challenges, but as overall, it's a very positive thing. I'm glad that we have these updates, and now this gives us a lot more flexibility in many ways. What we need to tackle, however, the biggest problem always is the mentality of the people. So for many, many years, we have used to do things in a particular way. And now we have a new guideline which tells us, well, no, you can actually make a decision how you want to do that. And my biggest concern is that people will push back and say, oh, no, we are used to doing it this way, so we'll just continue doing it this way. That's my biggest challenge with the new GCP. I really hope that companies decide to benefit from that flexibility that's given to them and try to do risk assessment and design clinical trials in a better way. That's what I'm hoping for. As always, I always hope for global harmonization. So if we can have agreement between everyone so that things are, you know, follow some pattern and not every country has its own weird requirements, that will make a big difference for all the companies working in the industry. It will make difference for all patients, because then it will streamline clinical trials globally, and more people will have access to new treatments. So I'm really hoping that the regulators will embrace that opportunity for more flexibility and more risk proportionality, and that approach is really a positive one. Thank you for listening. I hope that was interesting.